The Guardian.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample.
If you've got an elephant ever and then it stands up, sort of that hugeness of motion underneath you, you can feel that in the whole space shuttle.
He was the first Canadian to walk in space, the first Canadian to command the International Space Station, and the first human being ever to be born with a moustache. Okay, I made up that last one. I'm talking, of course, about Chris Hadfield, the former astronaut who has inspired millions with his space photography, in writing about his life, and of course that hit cover of David Bowie's Space Oddity. This week's podcast is a Hadfield special and pulls together the highlights from a Guardian Live event we held with Chris at the Royal Geographical Society in London this week. It was a packed room and the audience had plenty of questions for Chris on his time in space, but he started with a presentation of photos taken from the International Space Station and he told us what it's like to fly into space.
I thought I would just start off by talking about what it's like to fly a rocket ship, because it's such a rare experience. And probably first off, the most important thing to say is we don't ride rocket ships. We fly rocket ships. We aren't passengers just hoping things are going to go right with our fingers crossed and shivering like chihuahuas in the cockpit. We are intrinsically involved with trying to safely get to orbit, and it is really hard. You know, we sort of take it for granted a little bit, but it is extremely complex to be able to take up to 7 human beings at a time and leave Earth and get them up there. And I flew on Atlantis, and I flew on Endeavour, and then I flew the Russian Soyuz. And the problem is the same. You have to get going above the atmosphere, and then you have to get going fast. Just to stay in orbit is 8 kilometers a second, or 5 miles a second, if you want to stay in orbit. If you want to leave Earth, you have to go 40% faster, so about 12 kilometers a second. If you can get going 12 kilometers a second, you can go to Pluto. But we are just going to orbit. So what these rocket ships do is take you from sitting like you are right now, and in 9 minutes, get you going 8 kilometers a second. It's phenomenal. It is like the most powerful beast you've ever been in your life, with the foot to the floor for 9 minutes, just going faster and faster and faster. And the two of them are similar. And it's an extremely rough ride. But the ride starts, depending where you want to draw the line, decades in advance of actually getting on board. In my case, I decided to be an astronaut when I was 9 years old, just about to turn 10, when the first two people walked on the moon. And I made a conscious decision at 9 years old to try to start turn myself into an astronaut. So that I'm Canadian, so that when the Canadian Space Agency said, hey, anybody want to be an astronaut? I could stick my hand up higher than anybody in the country.
When you were a 9-10-year-old thinking of becoming an astronaut, did you know what the job involved?
Yeah. You get a nickname like Buzz and you walk on the moon. I thought, I can do that. But in truth, of course, all of our distortion of reality, all of us have our own particular distortion of reality. It's slightly more fanciful when you're a kid. But at 9 or 10, you're reading some of the newspaper headlines, you're starting to understand something external to the life that you've led to that point. And so I looked at it and I thought, well, how do I become an astronaut? What do astronauts really do? And so I looked for examples. Canada had no astronaut program. We had no space agency. But I thought, well, so what? This morning it was impossible to walk on the moon. And by bedtime, people walked on the moon. Impossible things happen. That was to a 9-year-old boy, that was like permission. You know, impossible things happen. Look, and they don't just happen because they have to. They happen because they just barely can. And because a whole bunch of people really worked hard, and suddenly impossible things happen. So that was like, it can happen. But then I'm like, well, what do I do? You know, I have no idea. But I looked at those first space explorers, Yuri Gagarin and Alexei Leonov and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and John Glenn. And I went, well, they're educated. I'm going to have to go to university. They're in good shape. I'm going to have to keep my body in shape. And what do? They fly in space. That's a verb. I should learn how to do that. So I learned to fly. And they do spacewalks. So I learned to scuba dive. And I just constantly challenged myself to gain skills. And I recognized that that when they did across Canada say, hey, who'd like to be an astronaut? If I said, I have no qualifications, but I'd like to, please, that wasn't going to hack it, that I needed to have turned myself into who I wanted to be and hopefully enjoyed the transformation along the way.
You got over some of that fear of heights by learning to jump off the rafters in your parents' barn into piles of grain and going higher and higher and higher. And it sounds like at NASA, I presume the strategy of getting you to come to grips with things that would otherwise be very scary is different. But you...
Well, a large part of life, I think, is what do you do with fear? Because we all fear things. And it might be something tiny. I'm afraid of whatever. I'm afraid of ticks, or I'm afraid of spiders, or I'm afraid of driving a car, or I'm afraid of getting married, or afraid of changing jobs, whatever. Whatever you're afraid of, it's natural to be fearful when you don't know or can't control consequence. But really the measure of life is what have you done with your innate fear? And for me, I think everybody should be afraid of heights. I think if you're not afraid of heights, you're not going to live very long, you know, or you don't understand. But I am not afraid of heights if I can't fall. If I know for sure, like right here, I'm sitting on this stage, but this stage is holding me up. And we aren't at sea level here. We're some way above sea level, but I know that there's no way to fall. However, if the edge off this stage were 10,000 feet straight down, it would be an entirely different feeling for me because my chance of falling is only a meter away. If I am sitting here bolted to this wall, or if there's a handrail this high and it's 10,000 feet down, then that's okay too because I cannot fall. Or if I'm sitting in an airplane that has wings holding me up, I'm strapped into a chair, I can't fall. You know, I'm held up just as I'm held up by the floor right here. If I were standing on the wing holding on with one hand, that would be different. And on a spaceship, it's different too. People say, well, the Earth is below you. In fact, the Earth is above you. So your body doesn't think you're going to fall up anyway. So there is no sensation of falling. And you're weightless already. So you have much more of a sensation of going around the sun with the world. So I'm still afraid of heights. Boy, when I stand on a cliff, I have that horrible liquid feeling and my legs are shaking and my body's screaming at me to stop being such an idiot. And I think that's a good thing.
You were the first Canadian to spacewalk, and you can only practice for that by going in the huge pool at Houston. When you first climb out of the International Space Station, whether the Earth looks up or down, it must be quite an experience. Tell us what it's like.
Out in the vacuum of space, it is a completely inhospitable environment. If you went outside right now, we have air pressure around you, squeezing in on your body right now. As soon as you went outside, basically your lungs would collapse because your lungs aren't strong enough to hold the bubble inside. So, boom, your lungs would collapse. And then all of the slightly damp parts of your body, like your eyeballs and your tongue and your lips and everything, it would all boil immediately because there's no pressure to stop the water from boiling off. So your eyeballs would start boiling. And then just like opening a can of Coke, your blood right now is at about 14 or 15 pounds per square inch or 13.2 millibars. And if you suddenly went to zero, it would be like opening a can of Coke and your blood would fizz. So your body would fill up with foam. And so it would be a race to see which would kill you first. But it would be a very brief race. So we wear this enormous suit to keep most of those things from happening. And the suit it looks like just an extended piece of clothing, but in truth, it's a one-person spaceship that is sort of custom built around your body. People ask me, what's a spacesuit cost? It's sort of an irrelevant question because there are only 12 suits in the world, and it's made of piece parts every time. You slip into this hard fiberglass upper torso, but then the arms you get off the shelf for the ones that are the right length for your arm, and your legs the same way, and you adjust all the pieces. It's sort of like an assembly kit, you know, like Christmas Eve where you're building something. And so there's not really a suit, and there are only 12 of those hard upper torsos. But you build the suit around your body, and then you open up the hatch, and you pull yourself out into the universe. And at the time, I was completely technically ready for what was going to happen. I had studied it and trained it and thought about it and practiced it. I'd spent hundreds of hours underwater. I knew every little, it was like a ballet. I knew every choreographed move I was going to make, flick of the wrist, what I was going to do next. Coming outside, like a chick coming out of an egg. Watch what happens when I first see the world. I was absolutely gobsmacked by it. I had not been prepared for the gorgeousness of the planet itself. It looks nothing like a globe going by, where globes are smooth and shiny, and every country is a different color, and there's nice lines, and it all looks very uniform. The world is textured, and the angle between you and the sun and the world constantly changes because of your speed. So the textures are brought out by the constantly changing sunlight, and then there's weather, and it's going by so fast. I mean, you cross Africa in 4 minutes, so you see it all, and it's happening so quickly, and you're holding on. And if you look the other way, the blackness of space, it looks like if you put your hand into it, it would come back with the universe on it. It's just so profoundly dark. And you are in the middle, holding on with one hand. And at one point, we were coming across the Indian Ocean, and I shut off my lights. It was in the dark. I was riding on the end of the arm. I had removed a bunch of thermal covers off the big new Canadarm that we'd built. So I'm carrying all these thermal covers like a big bag of laundry, riding on the end of the robot arm as it was taking me around to the airlock to stuff the laundry into a bag. And so I was like, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. And we were coming across the Indian Ocean, and I thought, hey, I'll look at Australia in the dark. So I shut off my headlights just to let my night vision adapt so I could see. Yeah. And I wanted to see, you know, see Perth and Adelaide and Melbourne and Sydney. But instead of seeing Australia, we went through the southern lights. What? Through them, so that they were like rippling by between my legs and under my feet. Cameras do okay. It shows the green, and maybe if you look close, a little bit of the red. But when you're flying through the southern lights, they're yellow and orange and purple, and they're flowing like a big living sheet of color, like this enormous living rainbow. It's just, it's phenomenal. And so I was being driven on the arm by Jeff inside, Jeff and John Phillips. And I said, oh, guys, you got to see this, the southern lights. And the arm went, and they shut off all the lights in the shuttle, and then they got to the windows and took pictures, and then we drove up across New Zealand and drove into the sunlight and got back to work. But if you're ever out on a spacewalk, remember to shut off your lights, because it is such an incredibly humbling sight. And this is our first step away from the world. You know, we've been sitting in our mother's laps for our entire civilization, with the rest of the world just sort of a spectacle, look up at it. This is in the universe, going through it with the world. And it's just our first little step away. But I can picture what it's going to be like, sort of like the Orion launch a couple days ago. When we get in a spaceship and fire those engines long enough, not just for 8 kilometers a second, not even 12 kilometers a second, but up to 16 or something, where Earth is in the rearview mirror, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. That sense of adventuring out into the rest of the universe, which we're in the process of doing, you really start to get a taste of that when you're out on a spacewalk. Boy, that was a long answer.
Before we go to the audience, let's just talk quickly about Mars. There's so much to talk about in space at the moment, but we've seen NASA's Orion capsule trialed over the last few days, very successfully, plans for NASA to go to Mars. And several private companies as well. Do you think it's a sensible strategy to head for Mars, or should we be looking at going to the moon and doing something, a moon base, something more complicated there? Is Mars just a bit too ambitious?
There's nothing wrong with ambition, and there's nothing wrong with setting a long-term goal. I think there is a problem with setting an unrealistic timeline, because if you make an unrealistic timeline, then you inherently disappoint the people that should be supporting it. So if we told everybody we're going to be on Mars within 2 years, and then 2 years came and went and we still weren't on Mars, why would anybody believe us or support us? And Helene and I lived, my wife's here, by the way, we lived in Houston for 21 years, and one of our neighbors was John Young. You don't know John Young, but he flew the first flight of Gemini. He did the first flight of the lunar lander on Apollo 10. He landed on the moon on Apollo 16 and walked on the moon, and he did the first flight of the space shuttle. John was a heck of a neighbor to have. And he used to watch our dog when we went on vacation, too. And John Young says something regularly, which I think is great. He says, Mars is further away than most people think. And John knows, because he's walked on the moon. Mars, a lot of the time, is on the other side of the sun from us. It is immensely far away. And the distance between us and Mars in time with the engines we have right now is like 6 months. Just if things go perfectly, it's going to take 6 months to get there. Think of Franklin. We don't know how to tin our food for 6 months, really. We don't know what the environment, we don't know what to bring. We don't have the right engines. You know, those two ships had, one of them, the steam engine in it came from an early locomotive out of a mine. But the steam engine technology was still really early. They didn't have iron ships even then. They were doing their best, but they took a tremendous risk and they lost. And if we started going to Mars anytime soon, everybody would die on every single flight. We don't know what we're doing yet. We have to have a bunch of inventions between now and Mars. So I think it's a fine long-term destination. But what we're learning on the space station right now is absolutely pivotal to go to Mars. How to store your food. How much food do you need? How does the body process food after months in weightlessness? How do you keep the body healthy? How do you not have your bones degrade? How do you not go crazy? How do you communicate? And once we get away from the world, how do you navigate? And when the communication becomes so slow because of the distances, and how do you protect yourself from the radiation? Because close to the Earth, we got the magnetic field. It's like a force field protects us. Going through the Van Allen belts and then into pure interplanetary space, the radiation, we don't even know what effect it has on the human body. We are previous to Franklin in our ability to go to Mars right now. So it's easy to say, let's go to Mars. That's the easy thing. And there's lots of people who have said that recently. Yeah, we're going to Mars. We haven't got any spaceships yet, but we're going to Mars. And we have a lot of things to invent first. And we're doing it the right way, which is sail within sight of land, which is what we're doing on the space station, to test everything. Because if we get it wrong, instead of all dying, wandering around dragging a sled somewhere in the Arctic, we can just get in our little Russian Soyuz and land within 2 hours anywhere on Earth. So we can. And if we go to the moon, we're only 3 days away. As soon as we have fired those engines, so we're going 12 kilometers a second or faster, we can't turn around. We won't have the fuel to slow down to zero and then accelerate to come back. We have to go all the way to Mars just to use the gravity of Mars, if we had a real problem, to slingshot around and come back to Earth. So as soon as we fire those engines, we are committed to a year in space minimum, no matter what fails. So we have to invent better engines. And what do you make your spaceship out of? We're testing all that on the space station. And right now we just have the Soyuz, but these two are starting to be built in the States, one by Boeing and one by SpaceX, to take us to the space station and back. And what Elon Musk is doing is brilliant. He's trying to build a first stage rocket that, instead of just falling in the ocean or coming apart, that will come back and land, so that all you have to add to it is fuel every time. He's hoping to get the price of a launch down to like $500,000, where right now it's, you know, two orders of magnitude higher than that. So we're learning a lot from these. And then Orion, which its first launch was just a couple days ago, I mean, it was an unmanned test, but it went out thousands of miles from the Earth, further than we have been with a man-rated vehicle in 42 years. And it came smoking back into the atmosphere, that little capsule on the front, going 82%, I think, of the energy for a ship coming back from Mars. So the heat shield, we could test everything. And the engineers that built that thing, that was so hard, and they did it perfectly. I mean, they did a great job. And that center section there is going to be built by the European Space Agency. That's built by NASA, and the engines are built by one of the big aerospace companies in the States. So for me, that is a great vehicle, but where we're going to go next is the moon. That's where we're going to go, because it just makes sense. It's only 3 days away, and we can invent so many things. And it's good for NASA to stand up and, you know, just get popular opinion. We're going to Mars, but they say in the 2030s. I mean, that's how many presidents between now and the 2030s?
Is that realistic?
That's, you know, oh, it may be realistic, but how can you predict the pace of invention? Mm. That's really what you're trying to do. It's like Franklin's crew saying, hey, when do you think we're going to invent steel hulls or GPS or whatever, you know, or being able to map the ice in the Arctic so we're not caught by mistake by it. We have to invent a bunch of things. And I think we're going to be on the space station for the next 15 years, and then that same sort of international consortium that has allowed us to build and peaceably build a space station, we should include China, and we should include India, and we should have a permanent base on the moon, just like we've done in Antarctica for the last 50 years. And then, and not as the main effort of the world, but as one of the things we're doing. We'll learn so much about the planet from seeing it from the moon permanently, because it's a wonderful observatory. And on the other side, to understand the universe without the atmosphere in the way. And once we've tested and invented new engines, then we'll go to Mars.
Let's get some questions from the audience.
Oh, I am distressed about those people killing each other over land border and over island, lots and lots of places all over this little planet. What would be your thoughts?
Hi, I'm 16. I'm going to be an astronaut. I was wondering... what should I be doing at this point in my life to turn myself into an astronaut?
You should come to a lecture by an astronaut. That's
okay, we'll let's have your question.
On your book, you mentioned that you constantly train and your rational brain takes over your, you know, emotions or sentimentalism in a way, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to keep focus and just solve things one after the other. But I would like to know what most surprised you about yourself that you couldn't possibly train or think of until you actually were in the situation that you just couldn't prepare for?
Okay, great. Three very different and good questions. So the first question is about looking at the world and despairing about the internecine and fractious and destructive way that we treat each other, especially over borders, which are largely invisible and constantly changing, and especially little islands of humanity. And islands exist in figuratively and literally, of course. The first time you go around the world, you are just like anybody else the first time seeing something. You want to look for stuff you recognize. And you actually sort of point out to yourself the places that you've been. Probably everybody here at some point has said, go to that Facebook app or something and said, which countries have I been to? And stuck a little virtual pin into those. Say, like, these countries have significance because I was there. Right? I don't know why else we do that. I do that. And you feel that way in space. And in fact, you want to grab one of the other astronauts and go, hey, look, that's where my high school graduation was, right there. Look, look, look. And the other person goes, yeah, hey, nice. And then the second time you come around the world, you go, oh, yeah, that's where my high school graduation was. And then the third time come around, you go, wow, look at the Great Lakes. I had no idea that's how they looked. And then the fourth time around, you're going, holy cow, look at James Bay. You can see where the glaciers receded for the last 15,000 years. And the fifth time around, you start to see the whole world. And the 500th time around, you see the whole world as one place. It's inevitable. It seeps right into you. And to answer your question, every single person in this room, probably right now, whether you've thought about it or not to yourself, you have some circle that is us. And you have everybody outside of that little Venn diagram circle that is them. There's an us and them in your life. Like if something, right now, they are getting pounded in the Philippines by an enormous typhoon, and almost a million people have evacuated. But for most of us in this room, all those people in the Philippines are them. And it's not really affecting you. And so even though it's a tremendous number of people in distress, imagine if that were happening right here, it's beyond the line of us and them. And so you don't fret about it. You might not even think about it. You might not even know about it. You might not even know where the Philippines are because it's them. If you came on board the spaceship with me and we did 100 orbits together, that line starts to disappear. Where does us end and where does them begin? And for me, it just receded further and further and further until collectively, unconsciously, the whole thing just becomes us. And almost all of the tribal squabbles that we have and the reasons that we have for doing them are because of a personal definition of us and them that is incorrect for a species, that is unhealthy for a species. And it's so ancient, especially today with the level of transportation ease that we have and the level of communication ease and the education level that we have. There is no excuse for the perpetuated ignorance with which we treat each other. And so how do we get past it? I'm not some sort of doe-eyed, you know, idiot either. How do we get past it? And you have to let people see the whole world for what it truly is. Because you can focus on your little square of pavement or sand or whatever and think that that's the only part that matters, just like your great-great-great-grandparents did. Or you can start to see the world as one place where we are all in this together. And that's so much of what we see from the space station, and it's part of the impetus of my second book also, was just to see the world for what it truly is. Not to tell you what to think about the world, but when somebody says to you, I don't know, Dubai or Addis Ababa or Auckland or something, instead of being, yeah, that's them, I don't care, it is another part of us. It's just one long continuum of us. That's what the world is. And we're all crew on the same spaceship. And as soon as we can start to see ourselves that way, we will advance tremendously. But it's a tough process. And we have years and years and centuries of traditions that work against it. But it's getting better, I think. Hopefully, through continued education, influence, travel, and communication, we can treat each other better. All right.
Can you remember?
And as my wife says, makes a nice Christmas gift. Anyway, and this young lady asked if you want to be an astronaut. Three things primarily. Number one is you need a proven ability to learn complicated things. Because one of the biggest tasks as an astronaut, and it sort of gets to your question, is an immense learning task, a memory task, something some technician in Sevastopol in the Ukraine taught me in 2004 would be life or death for me in 2013 when something happened. How do I keep that thing in my mind so that if this particular emergency happens, I can do the correct five things? And that technician at the time, he said to me, hey, just remember this one thing. And people did that for 20 years with me. Just remember this one thing, because it'll be important if the space station starts filling up with smoke. And so the memory task is huge. And so when NASA or the UK Space Agency is saying, okay, we want to recruit an astronaut, we want someone who has a proven ability to learn complicated things. So how do you do that? Even an IQ test is like testing horsepower. It doesn't really test proven ability. So instead, hire someone who has a PhD in biomechanics or something, because they have proven their ability to learn something complicated. So that's step one. And so at least a master's degree in a technical field. But we're not hiring a particle physicist because when they get to the space station, they're going to do particle physics. It's good if they can, because we have particle physics going on up on the top. But they're there because they, no matter what they have to learn, they can learn it and figure it out and then do it. The second thing is, on board the space station, you are a long way from home. And we can't afford to go to the clinic. We can't afford to take you to the hospital. We can't afford you to have any sort of congenital medical problem that might cut short the length of your mission. When we send people to Mars, I mean, we need to send supremely healthy people, people with a very low probability of a medical event happening. So part of that you can control. Keep yourself in shape. Exercise and don't eat stupid food. You know, and just keep your body under control. It's, you know, everything you put in your mouth turns you into who you are. It's not that complicated, really, you know. And so think about the stuff that you're putting in your mouth and take the stairs and carry your bag. It amazes me who are p- people who are carrying gym gear who get on an escalator and stop walking. It's like, really? Yeah. Why does an escalator give you permission to be lazy? Keep walking, you know? It's just crazy to me. So you don't have to be a fanatic to keep your body in shape. It's just decisions every single day. And then the third is, so you have a proven ability to learn and a healthy body. And then the last is a proven ability to make good decisions when the consequences matter. And by that we mean where the consequences are high, financial or life or death. And so we hire test pilots, because the test pilots who make bad decisions are dead. And so we hire test, and we hire medical doctors because they handle life and death. And we hire people who have run programs because they have had huge financial and personnel consequences. And you can start to get good at making decisions right away. But you have to, decision making is a skill, just like carving or math. Decision making is a skill, and you have to learn it and put it into action and then sustain it and practice it. So start making decisions with your life and then sticking with them. And this month, I am going to learn 200 words in Japanese. That's a decision. This month, you can learn 200 words in Japanese in 31 days. It's not that hard. Do the math, right? You can do it. And by the end of the month, you will have given yourself a skill that you didn't have before. You will have done it because of your personal resolution. And it won't just be some silly little throwaway skill. You will be amazed if you learn 200 Japanese words, how suddenly a part of the world opens up to you that didn't exist before. When you're walking down the street, instead of noise, you realize, I understood what that person just said. I know what that sign says. You are building yourself a slightly higher platform on which to understand the rest of the world. So that's the three key things. And that'll whittle it down to about 500 people. And then you just the other things. How interesting a person are you? What experiences have you had? What have you done besides study? Are you going to be an interesting person to go to Mars with? You know, can you play something on guitar? Can you sing? Have you that type of thing. So be a complete person. And then the final part is, and this is maybe the most important, to set yourself a long-term goal like being an astronaut. I think everybody in this room should have set themselves a goal for who they want to be 10 years from now. If you haven't, then how do you know what to do next? I mean, how do you know what to do next if you don't know where you're trying to get to? It's just sort of random, right? Oh, next I'll do that. I don't know, whatever, see what happens. Why not say, if everything went perfect, what would I be doing 10 years from now? And how do you even know, right? And the easiest answer is, I don't know. Well, next time you go into a bookstore, I bet you when you walk into a bookstore, you don't go to every single section evenly. You probably go to certain parts of the bookstore because they interest you. You know, you always go to maybe the same three parts of a bookstore or a library. Then do yourself the favor of saying, those are the actual three areas in a bookstore that I fundamentally, in my heart, am interested in. And that's what really interests me. So let's extrapolate that and say, 10 years from now, if my life went perfectly, and what I really like and understand is, I don't know, ancient Egypt. I'm fascinated by the pyramids. 10 years from now, if my life went perfectly, I would be the guy who figured out where the Sphinx came from. I would love to be that guy. Nobody really knows. Does it actually have water erosion on the sides like we think it does? Was it actually just a few thousand, or is it 10,000? We don't know. Okay, here's my goal. 10 years from now, I'm going to be the guy who figures out what the Sphinx is. Okay, so what should I do this weekend? I think I'll read a book. I think I'll study how granite is degraded by water. I think I'll look at how the face of the Sphinx was changed over time. I think I'll look up what Sphinx means. I think I'll, whatever, it doesn't matter. By Sunday night, you will not be the person, likely, who has figured out where the Sphinx came from, but you will be slightly closer to being the person that you're dreaming of. So let yourself succeed. You will probably never be an astronaut. The odds are terrible. Make it your goal, but don't let being an astronaut be your measure of success. By the end of this weekend, if you suddenly did, you decide this weekend I'm going to do 1,000 sit-ups because astronauts need to be fit. Sunday night, your guts are going to hurt, but you're going to be a slightly fitter person, and because it's already Sunday, and but you can celebrate the words of Japanese that you learned. or the fitness that you've given to your body. Allow yourself to be victorious on a daily basis. Don't wait to succeed until some uncontrollable event in the far distance comes. And I think that is the way to conduct your life. Get those three pillars I talked about, but love what happens between now and then. Okay, and the last question was a memory task. The most difficult thing or surprising thing about spaceflight. The most difficult I touched on, and that is the memory task. It's huge. And the gratification deferred. In 1992, I was hired as an astronaut. And I'd been a fighter pilot intercepting Soviet bombers, but the Soviet Union had just come apart. And it looked like we were going to cooperate with the Russians. So I thought, wow, we're starting to cooperate with the Russians. I know like three Russian words, da, niet, and vodka. That's all I know. And perestroika, whatever that is. And so, well, I should study Russian because maybe someday I'm going to be doing that. That's what I should do this weekend. I should learn some Russian. So I studied Russian, and I studied Russian for 19 years, learning to speak Russian, hoping that someday that might be useful. And that was one of the very useful things to be able to command the International Space Station was to speak Russian. And I turned out I was the pilot of a Russian Soyuz. I wasn't a passenger on board. I could fly a Soyuz myself in Russian. So that type of memory task is immensely daunting and very difficult. But for what was surprising, I was completely technically prepared for what was going to happen. And not the small minutiae of knowing exactly what to do, but having studied enough breadth and depth of things that it may not have been exactly what I was ready for, but it was in the scope of things that were going to fail. I think the thing you're not prepared for is the personal impact of seeing the world from that vantage point. I wasn't prepared for just the stupefying nature of the world. You saw a little hint of it when I pulled myself out on the spacewalk, and it's when I say stupefying, that's what it is. It makes you stupid. It stops your thought. The raw, omnipresent beauty of the world. It is beyond magnificent to see the world that way. And not like looking at a picture or even looking through the window of the spaceship is nice. But to be outside where there's nothing between you and the universe but the little bit of plastic in front of your face. So you're basically there. And the power of the presence of the world, as told to me through my ability to see it. I think that was probably the most surprising and wonderful part of the whole experience.
That was Chris Hadfield speaking at the Guardian Live event at the Royal Geographical Society in London. That's all we have for you this week from me and all the science team. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.